So we're very fortunate to have Dr. Rush back speaking with us again. I believe you spoke with us in Dallas, so we really appreciated that. And Dr. Rush offers a unique perspective on sports-related concussion. As a certified athletic trainer and research, Dr. Rush has published numerous articles in scholarly journals. The focus of his research is to investigate the measurement of practices of current and novel measures of sports concussion in adult and adolescent athletes. Dr. Rush's previous studies have addressed reliability and validity of computerized neurocognitive tests and balance measures, and he currently expands upon his previous research with computerized tests to find out if these are going to be more effective or will they prognosticate or be able to somehow talk about the recovery process of someone and how that could be. Additionally, Dr. Rush has been involved with global efforts to expand the profession of athletic training. And prior to his current position, he served as an assistant professor at the University of Texas at Arlington for 4 years, where he taught with the athletic training program. Currently, he is an athletic trainer and faculty member at the University of Virginia Department of Kinesiology. So please welcome Dr. Rush.
Good morning, everyone. I appreciate everyone being in the audience this morning, especially being the first session of this great meeting. So first off, thank you very much for the Sport Neuropsych Society in order to allow me to present to you all this morning. And I've been asked to talk about a topic that really is where I feel that athletic trainers specialize in terms of concussion management, and that's the acute assessment and management of sport concussion. So I'm going to start this morning on a somber note. This is actually from the National Athletic Trainers Association office. And what this slide represents is the number of fatalities per state during a 5-year span associated partially with traumatic brain injury, but also catastrophic cervical spine injury, heat deaths, heat stroke, as well as other causes for death such as cardiac or sickle cell crisis, etc. And if you look at the numbers over a 5-year span, the numbers are staggering. So in California, 19 deaths. In Texas, 17 deaths over a 5-year period. So although the basis for the talk this morning is traumatic brain injury, is concussion, these numbers are numbers that as an athletic trainer, as working as a member of a sports medicine team, we can work effectively to reduce. Now, if we isolate this only to sport traumatic brain injury, so I say sport traumatic brain injury instead of concussion. On the next slide, I'm going to be talking about concussion legislation. Yeah, you know, concussion legislation is based on the identification and management of concussion, but it's deeper than that. It's actually traumatic brain injury legislation, meaning that traumatic brain injuries associated with sport can be prevented if individuals with concussions, a predisposing factor to potential more catastrophic injuries, are easily recognized and removed from sport. So if you look at 2015 by itself, there are 4 deaths associated, known deaths associated with blunt force trauma associated with American football. So if you look at these deaths, this also doesn't account for those autopsies that were not released. So there most likely are more. But at the same time, even in 2015, we still have 4 deaths that occurred to sport participation associated closely with traumatic brain injury. Now, in terms of concussion legislation or TBI legislation since 2009, every state has enacted, including the District of Columbia, some iteration of concussion legislation. With that being said, more recently, we've learned the effectiveness of this legislation. So since the implementation of the Zachary Leistat Law in 2009, we've seen a 92% increase in the number of reported concussions and youth sports. Now, those are for states with concussion legislation, but with states without legislation, and this is somewhat of a dated study because it only goes to about the halfway through 2012, even states without legislation still saw an increase in concussion reporting. Now, most likely this is driven by media or other educational efforts that are done in a community without concussion legislation. So though we see those promising results with one study, another study, more specific to the state of Wisconsin, showed there was no difference in the reporting of concussions prior to and following the implementation of concussion legislation or concussion law. When we look at sport traumatic brain injury or concussion legislation, well, where do the laws stand? How do they differ? Well, they really don't for a large part of the components of each law. They all require some form of education in terms of parent, athlete, coach, administrator, or stakeholder education about concussion. They all require, with the exception of one state, the removal of an athlete suspected of having a sport concussion in order to allow them to seek the appropriate medical care. Where they start to differ is who can make a return to play decision for that concussed athlete. Approximately 50% of states with concussion legislation identify a specific individual or a specific healthcare professional that can make that return to play call. The other 50% simply say licensed healthcare provider. So this could be an EMT, this could be a dentist, it could be an OB. There are a variety of individuals that can make this return to play decision as long as there's some type of documentation of that. Now, I feel pretty confident in pointing out the one state you see the non-specific concussion bill, and that's the state of Arkansas. So with that being said, each of these states, including the District of Columbia, have very similar concussion laws. The state of Arkansas, and I feel like I could quote this by heart by now, says we're going to dedicate $1 million to concussion legislation or concussion research, period. There's no removal from an athlete, suspected athlete of having concussion. There's no education component. It's simply we're going to dedicate $1 million to concussion research, period. I think by in 2016, by this point in time, we can start moving through our second iteration of that particular law. Where are these concussions coming from? So I see concussions in terms of sport. And if you look at a data set from 2006, and this is the hallmark data set that we pull this stat of up to 3.8 million concussions occur each year. We've all heard that, but this is actually the study it came from. And you can see that sport, or being struck by or against something, accounted for 19% of injuries that were reported in emergency departments. Third to falls and motor vehicle accidents. And this is in 2006, and the data set was predating that publication as well. If we look at a more recent study at an isolated emergency department, in 2013, sports surpassed falls and motor vehicle accidents, accounting for 35% of injuries that were reported to emergency departments. So again, this is another sign of concussion legislation doing exactly what it was meant to do, readily identify, remove an athlete from competition suspected of having an injury, and allowing them to seek medical care. The other point that I want to point out about this is 20 to 30% of injuries, whether it was in 2006 or 2013, were accounted by or for by sport. That was the mechanism. 70 to 80%, and another way to look at this, 70 to 80% occurred outside of sport. So I think we're very familiar with the concept of it's just not sport that is really the reason for the increasing rise of concussions that we see. Motor vehicle accidents, when I was at the University of Georgia, mopeds were the number one cause of concussions. But so there are other factors that we need to take into account. It actually pushes us as athletic trainers outside of our domain of working solely with the physically active, and we might be seeing athletes coming in from a weekend car accident that are made, they present to us with a concussion that we also have to manage. So more specifically, who are certified athletic trainers? If you have not worked with a certified athletic trainer, this might be a new health profession that you are trying to get a grasp on to see what type of health professional we are. This is a definition from our NATA website, but we're simply skilled healthcare professionals that prevent, manage, and rehabilitate athletic injuries to the physically active. So not just sport, but we've actually expanded beyond the sideline, beyond the high school setting, the college setting, the pro setting, to venues such as the military, the performing arts, as well as industry, like Delta employs athletic trainers to care for its staff, as well as research. And Dr. Guskowitz, I'm looking forward to his talk later this morning, but really has pushed athletic training in the forefront in terms of our knowledge base, our expertise, our willing to collaborate, as Summer pointed out, with other healthcare professions in order to manage this injury. This is an injury that's not going to be managed by one discipline alone. In terms of how prevalent are athletic trainers within the United States in terms of high schools having access to this healthcare professional, this is a map from the Corey Stringer Institute that was published in 2012. And you can see that we have Alaska, that only 4% of public high schools have access to an athletic trainer. This doesn't mean full-time. This could be part-time. This could be a acute clinic piece. But from 4% all the way to Pennsylvania, with 96% of high schools have access to this expert in managing the prevention, management, and rehabilitation of injury. And, of course, our goal as a profession is that every high school athlete has access to high school athlete or an athletic trainer. So when we look at certified athletic trainers, where do we see ourselves? As an athletic trainer, we see ourselves at the center of the sports medicine team. When we take our position at the high school, when we take it at the college level, one of our first jobs is to develop the sports medicine team around ourselves, but more importantly, around the student athlete. It's not a self-serving concept. It's a matter of saying we want the best medical care for each athlete that we see, whether it's a relatively common injury, such as an acute ankle sprain, a more complex injury, like a protracted or prolonged recovery from a concussion, to cardiac issues. And we need to build that team around us in order to ensure that quality of healthcare for each athlete. So stereotypically, we work underneath the supervision or direction of a physician. But in more recent years, probably over the last two decades, that sports medicine team has developed beyond the relationship between the physician and the athletic trainer to incorporate several different disciplines in order to account for several issues that we see in sport. Now, in terms of the National Athletic Trainers Association, we have several position statements. I feel a little awkward presenting on this because I'm going to be talking about something that's been in place since 2002, yet a lot of individuals, a lot of groups, a lot of facilities, a lot of venues don't do it well, and that's the development of an emergency action plan. So an emergency action plan is simply to develop a plan, implement a policy in order to care for a potential catastrophic injury or situations such as a lightning strike, etc., in order to best provide care for athletes or individuals associated with unexpected or unforeseen event. So with this, I'm going to take that emergency action plan, I'm going to gear it towards developing your concussion management plan. So though this was originally published in 2002, there have been several iterations. So in 2004, we had the NATA's concussion management position statement released, followed by another iteration of the 2002 document looking at sudden death in athletics, and finally our more recent position statement looking at the management of sport concussion. So let's see if this works. Now my video doesn't work. That's good for you because that's a markedly shorter presentation. All right, so let's go back here. So the point of this slide is to show the different venues that athletic trainers work in. So here we have the University of Georgia, Southeastern Conference football program, very well endowed in terms of the medical support at the sideline. So at any given time, you can have two orthopedic surgeons, a vascular surgeon, as well as a host of athletic trainers, as well as three or four EMTs, along with graduate student and undergraduate student support to care for athletes. This was a really nice video of Bakari Rambo, who sustained a concussion, and there were a lot of take-home points from this, but the biggest take-home point was you could see the athletic trainers tending to Bakari as he laid unconscious on the field. But you have other venues that athletic trainers are working in as well. So the video on the left, although it's not a video that I took, but it was reminiscent of my time at South Dakota State University, where I worked with the club hockey team, where I was the club hockey athletic trainer, which means that the other team may or may not have an athletic trainer. And I love this video because it was reminiscent of one of the more memorable nights as a clinician, where there were roughly seven fights on the ice. And suddenly I was not just responsible for caring for a potential concussion, but also every other set of athletes that were fighting on the ice to make sure they were okay, as well as the refs as well. So again, our position as athletic trainer can vary from venue to venue, and probably the more concerning arena that we're in right now, or we're not in, is that of youth sports, especially Pee Wee sports. And this video, I think, has gained a lot of popularity, but it's simply showing a young athlete spearing the other athlete, resulting potentially in a concussion, that the question is, well, who's going to take care of that young athlete? Who's that individual going to seek care from? Or are they simply going to go home and mom and dad are going to say, you're fine? So in terms of the concussion management protocol, again, the emergency action plan for concussion, I'm going to speak on specific components that I'm going to bring together at the end of this presentation. Specifically, I'm going to talk about personnel. And Summer did a wonderful job talking about this interdisciplinary approach in concussion management and who that, as an athletic trainer, we foresee being part of that team. Equipment, or more specifically clinical measures associated with concussion management, along with concepts related to the venue location, the facilities that we have access to, and of course the documentation and implementation of a concussion management protocol. So starting off with personnel, what is the role of the athletic trainer? So prior to the start of any season, one of our key things that we do as a profession is we educate not only about concussions but other conditions as well, such as heat illness, etc., cardiac conditions. But with concussion management, a lot of concussion management is simply the education, making athletes, making parents, other stakeholders aware of the signs and symptoms of an injury so they can report. After that, and almost concurrently, we're developing our concussion management team. So this is upon arrival at a high school for your first time, a new position as an athletic trainer, where we're looking through the community to develop our concussion management team. As neuropsychologists, I can tell you, we want to work with you as athletic trainers. But sometimes it's difficult for us to find a neuropsychologist that wants to work with a high school or with the athletic trainer. And sometimes maybe there's a desire on both sides, but that communication is just hard to establish. So in that case, it's reaching out to the high school athletic trainer or making yourself known to say, yes, I do want to assist with your concussion management. But again, more stereotypically, we have the general physician or team physician, maybe an orthopedic, as well as neurologists, especially with prolonged recoveries that we want to build into our sports concussion management team. In addition to education, in addition to this development of this policy and this oversight team, we also have to make sure our athletes participate in pre-participation examinations. More specific to concussion, we want to know the history of concussion. So does the athlete have no prior history of concussion, or maybe are they coming to us with a history of 5 concussions? What do we do with that athlete? And that's where we bring in that team to say, let's discuss this athlete's career, their eligibility for participation in sport, or how they're going to participate in sport. And finally, another role of the athletic trainer prior to an injury occurring is the baseline assessment. As a profession, as the speaking on the behalf of the National Athletic Trainers Association, we strongly recommend the baseline assessment. So a pre-morbid or pre-injury assessment of the athlete's motor ability, cognitive ability, symptoms that the athlete may be experiencing prior to an injury. So we have a strong comparison following an injury in order to make sound return to play decisions. So at the time of the injury, the athletic trainer's role, and this is our head athletic trainer, Ethan Sliba, attending to one of our basketball athletes during this last year, our primary role is to rule out a catastrophic injury. The primary survey is to basically make this decision. It's very simple. Do we load and go, or do we stay and play? What that means is, can we get the athlete to a sideline in order to conduct a secondary evaluation, get a more detailed history, and further understand what might be going on with the athlete or monitor the athlete? Or do we load and go? Are there factors such as loss of consciousness, prolonged amnesia, potential for a C-spine injury that would allow us to defer to our EMS in order to transport that athlete to our emergency care facility for further evaluation and screening? As well as even after we get them to the sideline, we're still monitoring that athlete to make sure that they're not progressing or having a deteriorating neurocognitive or neural status, such as the exacerbation of symptoms, etc. So again, after we rule out that catastrophic injury or we decide we're going to stay in play, it's not only removing the athlete from play, but it's monitoring that athlete and continuing our assessment. So one of the first components of our sideline assessment, we can do some of this on the field as well, is the neurological examination. So here on the right, as Summer mentioned, I'm a former faculty member at UT Arlington, and these were some of our fine students that are going through, as an undergraduate athletic trained student, the cranial nerve assessment in order to rule out more severe underlying conditions that might rapidly deteriorate on the sideline. We spend a lot of time with the cranial nerve assessment to make sure our students are well-versed prior to entering as an entry-level athletic trainer. And as you can see here, we do our best to expedite this cranial nerve assessment, so maybe combining 2 or 3 tests that actually get at the cranial nerve that we're trying to assess. After we do our, that's one piece of the neurologic assessment. After we maybe do that as well as complement that with a more extensive neurological assessment, we then go to our secondary assessment looking at, you know, other factors that we may not be aware of, especially in a case with the hockey scenario where I might not know the athlete. And to me as an athlete trainer, that's one of the more scary things is when we confront an athlete that I have no idea what they're coming to me with in terms of not only their injury, I mean, the injury we can manage, but what other factors do they have that we're not aware of that might change our clinical decision-making? But also looking at symptoms, various assessments for mental status, looking at dermatomes, myotomes for muscle strength and control, which are really standardized in the standardized concussion assessment tool. And I'm going to talk a little bit about this. And some of my points might be a little controversial, but at the same time, I do feel that as being a healthcare care professional that practices evidence-based medicine. So taking the best available research evidence and combining it with my clinical expertise, we can use the SCAT3 effectively, as well as the other measures that I'm going to be talking about here this morning. So if you're not familiar with the SCAT3 is a combination of several different instruments from several different organizations combined in a multi-dimensional approach to the sideline concussion assessment, ranging from the Glasgow Coma Scale, which in most cases, most of our athletes with a concussion are going to present with a 15, very rarely. And you're going to see that later in the presentation, will they present with anything less than a 15, through the motor and cognitive assessment. So with the SCAT3, it does encompass this streamlined approach and the standardized approach to concussion management, if it's administered in a standardized way. Along with the SCAT3, we have the child SCAT3. And I'm going to present some data about these this sideline instrument, as well as others, that I want you to take for consideration when you're deciding, you know, should we incorporate this as a tool or not? So this is a recent publication that we had that really outlined the initial concussion assessment, from the acute assessment, where we were making that decision of, are we going to load and go, or are we going to stay and play, to the secondary assessment, where we get the athlete to the sideline, and we're in a phase of gaining that more detailed history, do a more thorough examination, and monitoring the athlete for any type of deteriorating condition. And one of the things that was a conversation between Jeff Kutcher and I was, you know, signs of stroke or deteriorating level of consciousness. You know, signs of stroke, you talk about concussion. I can tell you a few weeks ago we had one of our athletes have a stroke, a young female athlete. So at the same time, though this might seem like, well, stroke and concussion are different, it still happens, and it's something that we have to account for and build into our emergency action plan in order to treat the athlete. I'm very proud of our athletic trainer that managed that particular case. She didn't leave the emergency department for 3 days. She was there by the athlete's side to care for her. So again, that's that care the athlete trainers provide, which I find is unique. On top of the acute and the secondary assessment, based on our findings, the other key component, I've already talked about this prior to the sports season, but after an injury, one of the things that is so critical is the education, that take-home education for mom and dad, for the athlete, for the roommate, for the spouse, for a friend, whoever is going to be with the athlete over the next 24 hours or until they have that repeat assessment. And something education is simply make sure you do have that follow-up assessment, especially if we don't see the athlete again, if they're not our athlete. We want to make sure they're following through with their family physician or whoever is responsible for their health care, if not someone that specializes in sport concussion. On the right, and this is something I know you can't read that in the back. I'm not going to test you in the back there by the phone. But at the same time, the National Athletic Trainers Association has this really nice educational tool that can be copied and distributed freely that would be easily given to a parent, an athlete, in order to better educate about take-home instructions following an injury. So let's go back to that interdisciplinary approach. So I briefly touched on what the athlete trainer's role is in terms of concussion management, but who else is involved? So Don Comstock, I use this slide profusely, and this is actually data from 2012, but she's done such a nice job of doing a large epidemiological study looking at concussion as well as other injuries in the United States with high schools, with athletic trainers. And you can see that, for the most part, a majority of the concussions in her study have been evaluated by certified athletic trainers. Now, you look at the bottom and you see a total of 100%. And of course, mathematically, you can't have more than 100%. So this basically means that although the certified athletic trainer sees the athlete right away, there are other healthcare professionals involved with the care of the athlete. So there might be some overlap if an athlete's seen multiple times by multiple healthcare providers. But you can see towards the end of this list, you can see from 93% for certified athletic trainers, orthopedics see 32% of cases. Neuropsychologists and neurologists are at the lower end of the spectrum at 2.7%. And I think this, again, this has to do with the communication of saying, what do you want your role to be within the concussion management team? How can I work with the athletic trainer to provide better care for these athletes? And the other thing that I was looking over this presentation this morning that really is concerning to me was that other category. Who else is seeing these injuries? Are they qualified? That's another scary component that we need to shed light on. So with the concussion management personnel, that communication piece, that component of the emergency action plan development that's so critical, with the athlete trainer, we gain a lot of information about the athlete that we transmit to our physician, in some cases our neuropsychologist, which is two ways, right? It's bidirectional. Not once do we send information out and we don't receive information back. And I can tell you, I will tell you about our protocol at the UVA, but as soon as I get done with the assessment, I'm on the phone with our physician, I'm on the phone with our neuropsychologist, depending on the athlete, in order to say, this is what we found, what do you think, in order to make that best informed evidence-based decision about the progression of that particular athlete. Now, for those cases that are prolonged recoveries or they're unique injuries, such as individuals that take longer than 15 days at the college level to recover, we need to say what other factors could be at play here that we need to treat, because we don't want to continue to hold the athlete out, especially if there's something that we can pick up and treat for during that initial two-week period. And of course, in the rare cases, and fortunately, in my practice and working with concussions, I've had one subdural hematoma, which I'll talk on later and tell you about the limitations of the current clinical measures that we have as athletic trainers. But again, that information is transmitted back to the athletic trainer, and the entire team is communicating to work together to best care for this athlete. This is a slide that it's a little dated. This was developed by Scott Galloway, who's the head athletic trainer currently at DeSoto, and David Young took over his post for a little while at DeSoto High School in Texas. But this is a great way to just, it's a simple diagram, but it explains the roles of each individual's responsibilities within a concussion management protocol. So you have a team physician that's overseeing a neuropsychologist, the head athletic trainer, as well as myself. I was contributing data to this project, as well as the athletic trainers that work with the teams on a more day-to-day basis in order to come together as a team in order to make the appropriate return-to-play decision. But something this simple, distribute amongst your concussion management team and your coaches, your administrators, can really do a lot to educate about the process. So what do we do at UVA? So we start with the baseline assessment. Now, on the left, you're going to see, I have to make sure, on your left, you're going to be seeing the step or the component of the concussion management protocol that we do. So the baseline assessment. On the right, you're going to see who conducts that, what healthcare professional is responsible for it. So with the baseline assessment at UVA currently, we do the sensory organization test, a computerized measure of posturography or balance. We use the IMPACT, the computerized neurocognitive assessment, which Dr. Condor is going to be talking about later, as well as a SCAT-3, and then also an independent symptom inventory. We're looking at expanding our protocol right now to look at some novel approaches to the baseline assessment. In the event of a concussion, as diagnosed in the state of Virginia, this is state-specific, as diagnosed by the athletic trainer and or the MD, we don't reassess the athlete right away. And this is that evidence-based decision. Again, we know that the athlete's concussed. They wouldn't be seeing us at 24 hours if they were not concussed. Okay? So the question is, what information can we gain from that 24-hour assessment if we were going to repeat the impact, if we were going to repeat the SOT, if we're going to repeat symptoms? Once upon a time, with the research that I built a large part of my research profile on, we did do that 24-hour assessment, but my questions were data-driven. My questions were, what's the sensitivity to specificity, what's the reliability, or how well do these tests actually depict the individual that's concussed when they're concussed? So at the University of Virginia, instead of repeating that full test battery, we track them until they're symptom-free. And another key of that, I told you about the subdural hematoma, we saw an athlete in Texas came to our laboratory within 24 hours of injury, did impact, did the SOT, did self-reported symptoms, did not present any differently than a concussed athlete would, using over $130,000 worth of equipment. We tracked that athlete, the part-time athlete trainer at the school tracked the athlete's symptoms, and then 5 weeks later, we get a call. I get a call because I'm not seeing this athlete on a daily basis, more on a research basis. And it was a coach saying, this athlete's going into surgery tomorrow morning, did you know? And it's one of those moments where you pull over your car and you're thinking, what I missed? What could I have done differently? And it turned out that that athlete, from the point of injury until 5 weeks later, was developing a subdural hematoma. Usually subdural hematomas take around 2 weeks to develop. In this case, the athlete presented at 5 weeks. So again, even using over $130,000 worth of equipment, it has limitations. And it wasn't really meant to depict subdural hematomas or more significant injuries. So again, at that 24-hour time point, it brings in the question, should we tax the athlete? Should we get that clinical snapshot? If yes, great. That's your concussion management protocol, but for us, we moved away from that. Once athlete's asymptomatic, this is another thing that we deviate from. We actually start at stage 2 of the return to play protocol that It was going to be talked about a little bit later. I'll show you a slide about it in a second, where we actually exert the athlete with light exercise. So basically on a stationary bicycle or a treadmill, if the athlete remains symptom-free, then we'll re-administer the full battery of tests. Because the last thing we want is the athlete to clear our tests. We start exerting them. Suddenly they have a relapse of symptoms, and then we have to reassess them again underneath a doctor's instruction in terms of the neurocognitive, the postural assessment, et cetera. Because then at that point we're asking, are we really looking at recovery? Or are we looking at practice effects associated with the test? Each of the tests that I mentioned has practice effects. So again, we use that evidence-based decision in order to best care for our athletes. Once the athletes pass stage two and they're asymptomatic, then we repeat the impact, the SOT, the symptom scale. And to give you an idea of that graded return to play protocol, here's where the initial phase is no activity, which is really no different than what's recommended throughout the United States. We then progress into that light aerobic exercise, as I mentioned, stationary bike or a treadmill. And then after they remain asymptomatic, that's when we do our full battery of assessments. So based on those results, if the athlete's not within normal limits, after they progress through that initial stage of activity, or let's say that they were not within normal limits for impact or the SOT or symptoms, we'll wait 24 to 48 hours. We'll make that call again to say, let's reassess the athlete. Now, that window is variable because why? Every concussion is different. So it might be a week. It might be a couple of days. It's really that interdisciplinary approach that we use to determine that. If they are within normal limits, then we'll progress with the clinical examination with the athletic trainer as well as our MD, and then we'll proceed through the remaining stages of our return to play protocol, which results in that return to play decision. So that being said, that's the protocol that we use at the University of Virginia. I'm not saying it's the protocol. It's definitely not perfect. It's something that we have agreed upon as an interdisciplinary team in order to best care for our athletes as of 2016. Now, in terms of equipment, I mentioned this earlier. We use a SCAT-3, and this is kind of my controversial point during the presentation, where the SCAT-3, I believe, is a strong screening tool, but evidence has been out there. It's been published since 2001 showing that after 48 hours, it has limited applicability or clinical utility as a tool for concussion management. Why? As you can see on the right, you can see control in injured athletes return to baseline, if not exceeded baseline performance using the standardized assessment of concussion, which is a component of the SCAT-3, within 48 hours of injury. Okay, so again, maybe it's a great screening tool, but at the same time, it's not a tool designed in order to make a return-to-play decision. There are other issues, practice effects. The sensitivity recently was established, but there's an evidence-based caveat to that. Effects, influence of gender, do you have a baseline? Other injuries that can influence performance on the SCAT-3. All these factors limit the SCAT-3's clinical utility. In fact, one of the strongest components besides SAC for screening an athlete post-injury, I believe, is that symptom scale that comes with the SCAT-3. There are other sideline measures that I'm going to briefly touch on here. The clinical reaction time test is a relatively new measure, as well as the King-Divick has gained quite a bit of popularity with athletic trainers as a sideline measure. I would say at this point, evidence is still emerging about what is the clinical utility of these tests. So when I talk, I always have this disclaimer. I'm not saying don't use these tests. So usually I talk about impact. I'm not saying don't use impact. Use evidence-based framework to say, well, what's the best way to use impact? And Dr. Conner is going to be talking about that a little bit later. The same way with these other measures. Should we really incorporate these tests right now, or should we wait until the evidence is a little more substantiated? So if you look at the evidence, I broke down the reliability, sensitivity, and specificity of the different measures that are currently purported to be sideline measures of concussion. And you can see at the top, one of the most evidence-based measures that's currently out there is a standardized assessment of concussion. As I said, it's one of the more valuable components for screening an athlete following a suspected sport concussion. And in terms of reliability, we're talking about test-retest reliability. So how consistently does that athlete perform on a test from one time point to another while healthy? Sensitivity is the ability for the test to actually depict a concussed athlete as concussed. And then specificity is depicting a healthy athlete as actually being healthy. And we want course values for reliability to be closer to 1. I mean, perfect consistency, but also with sensitivity and specificity, you want values closer to 100%. Now, I Barry Bonds a few of these, and I'm going to talk about this as my 5 minutes. Are you kidding me? All right, I have 5 minutes. All right, so let me give you the short version. I feel like I'm going to do concussion management, Rachel Ray style here. All right, so with that being said, you have to look at the evidence supporting these particular instruments. So with the SCAT, there was really no evidence before we moved to the SCAT-2 and the SCAT-3, but they consist of different clinical measures that do have varying evidence to support their use. So with that being said, it's important to not only look at, though there is limited evidence supporting their use, the different individual measures and the evidence supporting their clinical utility. With the SCAT-3, we do see some emerging evidence, or I'm sorry, SCAT-2 on sensitivity and specificity, but you have to look at the time points at which this was administered. So though the sensitivity and specificity is relatively high, it was administered within 48 hours of injury. Therefore, going back to my comment about the SAC, after 48 hours is the bigger question. How do we track symptom resolution and overall recovery from a concussion? With the King-Divick, again, this is an issue where you look at the literature and you can look at the methodology, and I'll point out a few things. For the test-retest reliability, one study looked at establishing the test-retest reliability with 15-minute test-retest intervals. As an athletic trainer, we don't baseline test an athlete and then see them 15 minutes later. I'm more interested in the clinical long-term, so something more representative of an athlete having a baseline. 45 days later, we would reassess them to look at that stability of the test. And then sensitivity, that 90% I like to talk on, simply because that 90% is derived from 10 concussed athletes. It's not a large sample size. 9 out of 10 athletes that were in this particular study had a longer time to completion on the King-Divick test than what you would say you would see a larger study would potentially find. But more evidence is being published about these different clinical measures. And then with the clinical RT, again, you have to look at the methodology. You have to look at the publications around this in order to say what is appropriate for our clinic to incorporate into our test. So in 5 minutes or less, we do have clinical measures of balance that vary, going from sway balance all the way to a sophisticated measure of balance like the sensory organization test. So these units range from $60,000 to $130,000, where we have more portable units like the VSR Sport, which range around $12,000 to $17,000. So depending on what you're going to be using, you might be better off saying, well, I just want to use a $40 foam pad like the Balanced Error Scoring System. So if you look at the reliability of those measures, in fact, the best reliability and the most evidence-based measure of balance is the Balanced Error Scoring System. So we look at the more expensive measures, being the VSR Sport, a portable force plate, or the sensory organization test, and yet the Balanced Error Scoring System, a $40 foam pad, as well as it's administered well, as well as inter-rater reliability is achieved, has moderate to strong reliability, especially when compared to more expensive counterparts. In terms of validity, for sensitivity and specificity, again, the Balanced Error Scoring System, when administered in an acute period, so within that 48-hour window, as I alluded to in this 2015 study, does have a relatively high sensitivity, but specificity is lacking. There are other factors you need to consider when incorporating balance, like fatigue. These tests were not designed to be administered immediately after athletes removed to play. You need to let them rest for 15 minutes so you're not getting a false positive. Dehydration, believe it or not, does not influence balance. So that's something that would be for using like the Balanced Error Scoring System after removal from play after the athlete rests for 15 minutes. And there are practice effects, so we want to minimize the exposure to these tests over the recovery period. And there are other models out there with the Balanced Error Scoring System to show how to increase reliability. There's really not much out there about the modified Balanced Error Scoring System right now in terms of its applicability to assess balance following concussion. But if you remove a few conditions, I'll just simply refer you because of time to the Hunt article in 2009. There are modifications to the test that can make it more reliable, but also quicker. In terms of symptoms, I just wanted to point out quickly, this is a 2016 study by Wasserman showing the usual candidates for self-reported symptoms, the most common symptom being a headache. I also want to draw your attention to the least common symptoms, post-traumatic amnesia, loss of consciousness, amnesia, which some people still consider the hallmark for concussion, and we're way too far into the science to still believe that. The other side of this is some factors that we are now investigating or we should do a better job of educating with or incorporating to our concussion protocol, our balance disturbances, visual disturbances, but also insomnia, talking to our athletes about how to make sure that you're getting a good night's rest. There are a variety of scales out there. Is there a best one? My quick take-home point is no. It's simply using a 5-cent sheet of paper in order to track symptoms. We do prefer using a scale that takes into account severity of the symptom during the last 24 hours, but also a subjective reporting of duration. So did you have a brief headache during the last 24 hours, or has it been consistent during the last 24 hours? And we let the athlete tell us. So we found that duration of all things. If you look at outcome scores of impact, the sensory organization test, other demographics like prior history, concussion, gender, duration of symptoms during that initial 24-hour period did a really nice job of depicting who's going to recover within 10 days of injury or who's going to take longer. Now, the specificity dropped after 10 days. We just knew the athlete was going to take longer than 10 days in order to recover. But that formula is there for your review within the PowerPoint slides. And of those symptoms that were denoted, drowsiness, nervousness, tingling, neck pain, and at the time of assessment, total symptom severity. And I'll skip past this because of time. Again, with the evidence, it's somewhat lacking with self-reported symptoms, but at the same time, how do you feel right now compared to how you woke up this morning? You would assume that test reliability would be really hard to depict with a healthy sample. And sensitivity and specificity, it still is one of the most sensitive measures of concussion, but evidence-based practice tells us we can't always rely on the subjective nature of symptoms in order to really get at what we're trying to with our sport concussion management, and that's making that safe return to play decision. I threw up this slide just to summarize everything that I typically talk about. If you look at the reliability, the Pearson-R correlation, but also the interclass correlation coefficient, we don't have the perfectly reliable test. It does not exist. In terms of sensitivity and specificity, we do not have a gold standard for concussion management. We need the iPod. We need that point where we jump from the Discman, the cassette player, to this new way to look at the injury, the new gold standard, because currently we don't have a gold standard in order to assess injury. So until that time, it's an interdisciplinary and multidimensional approach to concussion management that's really the gold standard. I'm going to have you look this over after the presentation, but I broke down the different costs for each component of this multidimensional approach for cognition, balance, symptoms, with the basis of 200 athletes. So if you have time, look at this. I'd be happy to address questions afterwards about it and to fly through the rest of the slides. Again, it's that multidimensional approach which has been advocated and continues to be advocated in order to manage sport concussion, as well as the expertise combined as a sports medicine team in order to make the best return to play decision for our athletes. Yet, in 2013, this is probably the most recent study of practice, though this has been recommended really since 1997, only 21% of certified athletic trainers can employ this multidimensional approach. Not the athletic trainers, I feel, are doing a bad job, but it's also limited human resources and costs, the finances in order to employ this multidimensional approach to care for athletes. And finally, some parting words on implementation. These plans that we're talking about, these policies, are only good if they're written down and distributed and discussed. So not only discussed, but discussed a year later, 6 months later, once you decide what's the next step to our policy. One of the things I really respect Ron Corson for is after this Vicari-Rambo hit, the one thing you don't see is we had two orthopedics, a vascular surgeon, three EMTs, four certified athletic trainers trying to spyboard an athlete, as well as people surrounding the athlete. And even though that was amazing for a sports medicine program to have that, Ron called the team huddle afterwards, the day after, to say, what can we do better next time? We don't need this many people in order to spyboard. So it's that continual revisement, rehearsal, and discussion, especially as we produce evidence-based concussion management protocols. And I spent a lot of time on this slide, so I just want you to take this in. Summer, I got to talk about this slide. So as you change one thing, everything else is affected by in your concussion management protocol. So don't think you can implement a new test or a new policy without letting everyone know it, because that one new change, that even if you think it's little, will influence the remainder of your concussion management protocol. So regardless of state legislation, I believe strongly in a grassroots approach where we could surpass what states require for concussion management in order to provide evidence-based concussion management. Not once a concussion policy is created, we need to distribute it and discuss it liberally with everyone that's interested, all stakeholders with the plan, so they are not caught off guard when their son or daughter or their athlete has a concussion. especially with your sports medicine team. And then not only once you should not only should you develop a concussion management plan, but it needs to be revised. As I mentioned, there's developing evidence. We have new evidence coming out of our lab at the University of Virginia that I hope you would take into account to say, okay, I think we should incorporate this test, or maybe we should hold off on it, et cetera, or maybe this is the best way to administer this test. And then finally, as Summer mentioned and alluded to, this is not a sole discipline that's going to solve this issue, but it's disciplines working together. And despite everything I just spat out and way over my time limit, I want to show you this, my concluding slide, because I have a lot of questions. You probably do too. This is a discharge note from relatively recent, in the last year or so, from an emergency department that basically showed that an athlete that lost consciousness, had amnesia, had several symptoms related to concussion, sought care from emergency department, and this was the discharge note. And I'm going to emphasize what it says. Your child has been diagnosed with a minor head injury. A head injury is a very common reason for emergency evaluation. It goes on to say, your child did not suffer a concussion. Even a few years ago, with all this concussion legislation, we still have a long ways to go to work as a team in order to help athletes such as this make a safe and full return to play, and more importantly, return to life. So thank you very much. I appreciate your time and bearing with me.